All right, today One-on-One comes to you over the phone lines all the way to Gainesville, Georgia, where we're going to talk with an Olympic gold medalist, Milt Campbell, IU graduate, who won the decathlon in 1956, a really historic figure in the Olympic movement, a guy that IU alums and fans really should know more about and people from the state of Indiana should know more about because there's quite a story here, and he kind of fell through the cracks in the sense of Olympic history, and we'll talk about that. And Milt, let's get to your story. You grew up in Plainfield, New Jersey, correct?
I was born and raised, yes, in Plainfield, New Jersey.
Okay. Now, you excelled in so many sports. I mean, you're an Olympic decathlete. You know, that's a good place to start. You also were a great swimmer. You played football. As a kid growing up, did you have a favorite sport?
I don't know. I kind of followed in my brother's footsteps. I think, first of all, I was, most interested in, playing football because we played against my father in the yard and that type of thing. So you got to, and Dad played football. So you got to know a little bit about it. And then you would turn around and go off to high school. And, of course, you watched the high school games of your brother playing because he was like 2 years ahead of me.
Right. Did your brother go to IU?
Yes, Tom went to IU also.
Okay. We'll get to that in a minute. I was thinking I had heard that.
Yeah.
And your dad was a cab driver, correct?
My dad was a cab driver in New York. Yes, he was.
Okay. Now, you say he had been an athlete. Had he been a good high school athlete, that type of thing, or?
I don't know, but he was good in the he was good at home and all the athletic things that we ever seen him do.
Uh-huh. A natural athlete.
He played sandlot football, and that type of thing. So he was always out there, and he was always getting us in shape. I mean, he had my brother and I competing against each other when we were very young, running around the house. Whoever gets in first gets an extra pork chop or something like that.
So you're always competing, huh?
Yeah, and I got to the point where I kind of knew when Dad was going to say, okay, take your run around the house, so I try and get a head start on my brother so I could beat him.
That's good. That's good. Well, you were younger, so he had an advantage, no doubt. So you had to look for an edge somewhere, didn't you?
Yeah, but Tom was a great athlete. He was a good athlete. I think the only mistake that Tom made, he made a mistake of going into service for 4 years rather than going directly on to like Indiana and going to college.
Okay. Now, which sports did you compete in high school?
I competed in football, and then I ran indoor track, and I swam, and I also wrestled a little bit.
Okay.
In the indoor season, and then I ran track outdoors.
As a kid growing up, did you have particular teams or athletes that really inspired you or motivated you or that you tried to model yourself after?
Well, my brother was one of my biggest idols because he was always there and I could always see him and he sat at the same table I sat at, so figured if he could do it, I should be able to do it.
Yeah.
But when they picked teams on my block for, baseball or football or whatever games that we were going to play on my block, the last two people picked was my cousin and myself.
Oh.
And then they would pick her, and then they'd pick me.
You were the last one picked, huh?
I was the last one picked.
Because why? You were the youngest and smallest, or was everybody else
the youngest and so forth? And I guess I was, I wasn't as nifty carrying a football and that type of thing as the rest of them were. And being the youngest kid, they beat up on you a lot. And that type of thing. So I used to come home and my mother would say, don't go out there and play with them anymore. If you're going to come home and your teeth are loose and you've got a cut up by your eye and it hurts and all that sort of stuff. And I used to say to myself, well, nobody's going to beat up on me like this. I'm going back and do it again.
Yeah, so that was a great motivation for you, right, to be getting beat up and picked on and so forth. That kept it going?
Yeah, it was excellent motivation.
Had something to prove to people.
Right.
Okay. Swimming's an interesting sport, for you to be involved in. How did your interest in swimming come about?
Well, actually, we finished football our first season, And I wanted to, as a freshman in high school, I wanted to go out for varsity football, and the coach wouldn't let me. And he told me, he said, no, I think you should go down and play JV. After I had practiced with the varsity for a while, he said, no, I think you should go down and play JV. And if you go down and play JV, then what will happen is, you know, you'll make it on that team, and things we'll see how things work out for you. So we played JV, and we had an undefeated season, and Tom was playing varsity, and they had an undefeated season. So at the end of the season, everybody says, oh, I guess you're going to go play basketball like your brother, you know, and I said, no, I'm not going to do that. So I was walking down around the wrestling, and I wrestled with some of the heavyweight wrestlers. Then the next day I went into the swimming pool to, you know, just see how guys are swimming. So there was a top swimmer there, Plainfield, and the guy walked over to me. Now, you have to go back to the 40s, the late 40s and 50s, how America was and how it looked at us. And he said to me, he says, you're not going to try and swim, are you? And I said, yeah, I was kind of thinking about it. He says, well, you guys had a great football year. And he says, well, I don't think you can do this. And I looked at him and I thought, why don't you think I can do this, you know? And he says, well, it's not in your in your genes. I said, what do you mean swimming's not my genes? He says, well, you know, where you come from, where your family's come from in Africa, and all the waters are filled with crocodiles and snakes and that type of thing, you actually wouldn't learn how to swim. You know, and I said, okay. And then I thought, what the hell has that got to do with me? I was born in Plainfield, New Jersey.
Yeah.
And so, and so it turned around. Now the coach comes over. And all the coach can see is my big hands and my big feet, you know. And he thinks that if I can get this kid to propel through the water, you know, I'll make him a champion. And so the coach comes over and he says, hey, Milt, he says, would you like to swim? And I said, absolutely. I said, I would certainly like to swim. So he said, well, what would you like to do? What event would you like to do? And this kid was walking away by this time, so I pointed at him and I said, what does he do? And the coach said, well, he's our premier swimmer, our sprinter. I said, well, I want to do what he does. Okay. And at the end of the first year, we wound up first and second in most of the meets we had. And he wound up again state champion. And I was kind of like a runner-up to him. And the next year, I broke all of his records and became an All-American swimmer.
Oh, beautiful. Beautiful. So again, you had motivation. You were being doubted.
Well, I was the one that I guess if you go back in my life, you'll see where the motivation was my high point in almost everything I did.
Yeah. Did that other kid who had doubted your ability to swim? Did he ever come around? Did he ever say anything to you like, "Man, I was wrong"? That type of thing.
He came back from college one day and he says, he looked at me, he said, "Oh, don't say anything, please don't." It was kind of like, it was a stupid thing I said, you know. But I went on from there. It was that time, you know, America wasn't allowing, you know, blacks to be in community pools and that type of thing. So, you know, it kind of got all over the country that we couldn't swim. And actually, we had a very strong history of swimming. But it kind of like got all over everything. And then then they had that superstar thing.
Uh-huh.
And Joe Frazier, remember? He
went in the 70s. Yeah, the TV show. And Joe Frazier tried to swim.
Yeah, and he almost drowned, so he kind of like proved it to everybody, you know.
He set it back a long ways, didn't he?
Yeah, he did.
No, but it's true. I mean, even today, not that many blacks really go into swimming, but then again, not many inner city schools have a swimming pool. So.
Well, that's very true.
And not many opportunities, you know, to learn. But so you swam. You were a great high school football player.
Yeah.
You ran track, as you said.
Yeah, I lied to my swimming coach one day. I said, look, I don't want to swim. I don't want to practice. I don't feel good. So he said, well, you go home and you get your act together and you return back to school, and he said, I'll see you tomorrow. So our school was wrestling Thomas Jefferson from Elizabeth, and Plainfield and Thomas Jefferson were the two best wrestling schools pretty much in the state. And Thomas Jefferson had the best heavyweight in the state. He had lost one match the year before, and they said that, you know, he wouldn't he would be undefeated this year. So I go out and go up the back stairs, and I'm sitting in the bleachers kind of hiding myself, you know, watching the match. And all of a sudden I hear some throwing up coming out of the dressing room where our locker room was. And I asked the coach, I said, what's going on? And he said, well, the heavyweight was a little bit intimidated with the heavyweight of Thomas Jefferson. So he said he's getting his stomach is all upset, and so he's bringing up and everything. So I'm sitting in the stands. I said, hey, coach, I'll wrestle him. And the coach said, no, I don't want you to wrestle this guy. This guy will pin your ears back behind your legs back behind your ears, and he'll give you a spanking, you know. And I looked at the coach, and I said, well, don't get me afraid of him before I go out and wrestle him. I said, I'll wrestle him, you know. So after they talked about it for a little while, and they said, okay, put the gear on, Milt, let him wrestle him. So I go out on the mat, and the guy was really good. He was a good wrestler, but he slapped me upside my ear. And then he turned around, and he slapped me upside my ear again, and I pulled his hand down for the second time, and I told him, if you do that one more time, we're going to fight.
Really fight.
We're going to really fight. It's going to be like a street fight. So it turned around that he came back at me again, and I bent down and I picked him up and I had him up in the air, and I could hear everybody say, go down on one knee, go down on one knee, because I wasn't that versed at swimming. At wrestling. I thought I could just pick him up in the air and then throw him down on the mat and then flop on him or something, you know. So they said, go down on one knee. So I went down on one knee and I pinned him in 1:28. So
and he was
looked at me and just shook his head and walked away.
And was that the only time you wrestled for the high school team?
Yeah, that was the time I wrestled for it. They asked me to wrestle one other time, but I would have to get my swimming coach to get the time off, and I couldn't do it.
Ah, so you're an All-American swimmer in high school. As a wrestler, the one time you wrestled, you beat the state champion.
Right.
And then what about football?
Football,
high school football.
I set the scoring record in the state of New Jersey at one time in Group 4. I 140 points in one season, 8 games. And I played, I was all state, you know.
Yeah.
In all county, so. And then in track and field, I had numerous amount of national titles, in the hurdles and in track and field, in the high and low hurdles at that time.
Right, you're primarily a hurdler at that
right,
time.
Right.
Now, if at that time, what sport did you really want to pursue? Where did you want to go with your athletic career when you were in high school?
Well, in high school, I wasn't sure where I wanted to go. I think one of the things that I always wanted to do was play football with the Cleveland Browns, because they were a great team back in the 40s and so forth. And you're in the 30s, and so you as a young kid, you would attach yourself with great teams, you know. So professional football was out there, but my ultimate dream was to be the world's greatest athlete.
Ah, and why was that? Was there a particular motivation for that, or had you seen something on television, or?
Well, I was getting my butt kicked by everybody, that's why.
Okay.
My brother was a great athlete and so forth. And literally, I always said that if I can ever get to beat him, I would get to be the best athlete in the world.
Ah, you thought he was the best athlete in the world. In your world, he was the best athlete, right?
Well, absolutely. Absolutely. I think that if Tom hadn't gone into the Air Force, and he had gone to Indiana University like they planned, but he went in the Air Force for 4 years, and then he came back to Indiana. If Tom hadn't gone into the Air Force, Tom and I would have been on the same Olympic team, I think.
Oh, okay.
D2.
Yeah. Tom was a football player primarily?
He's a football player, played football, basketball, and also and also ran track and field, of course.
Right. I had a question there, and this is the part I'll edit out as we go along here.
Okay.
Did he give you a hard time? Did he taunt you? Did he bully you? That kind of thing. Did he try to?
It was a love-hate relationship.
Uh-huh.
You know, it was like when I was running the hurdles one day, I fell over the hurdles and I scratched myself all up. And of course, Tom was our state champion and held the state champion record in the hurdles and so forth. So when I turned around and fell over the hurdles and everything, he said, well, come on with me, you know. So I said, okay. So he brushed me off and everything, and he said, okay, let's run them again. And I said, no, I ain't running these no more. You know, I said, I had enough of it. He said, come on, you're going to run them again. He said, you know, we're not going home until you run them again. So he got into that mode with me, and I turned around and I said, okay, I'm going to run them. I said, but I don't think I want to run these things, you know. And I really did want to run them because he ran them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I simply, more than anything else, wanted to be, really wanted to be my brother's idol.
Yeah, interesting.
You know what I mean? And again, deep inside of me, I thought that the day that I can get to beat him, I'll get to beat anybody in the world.
Mm.
And so Tom now turns around, and he's a premier football player. I mean, he's a tough guy. You know, now we're out on the football field. So I go home after the track day, you know, all skinned up, and I love him because he made me do it again, and it was a good thing that he did make me do it again.
Yeah.
So I go home back as a as the next day we go back out to the football field, or when football season's on, and I'm trying to make the varsity football team, and of course he's he's turning around, hitting me, and I mean, knocking the heck out of me, you know. And he'll look at me, and he said, look, man, if you were Mom, I would have done exactly the same thing, you know. And I sit down at the dinner table. I hate this guy now, you know. So it was a love-hate relationship, but it was more love than anything else.
Yeah, he knew what he was doing.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, he was kind of, that 2 years that he was ahead of me, you know, made him wise enough to realize that this is the thing that's going to bring him along. And football, you know, as I tried to teach my son when he was younger, I told him football, you have to be mobile, agile, and hostile. And Tom said to me, he said, if you understand this, then learn to use your hostility when you need it, your mobility when you need it, and okay. And so I'm looking across the table at some guy who just beat up on me that's teaching me about the game.
Yeah.
But it taught me to learn the game that way.
Yeah. Oh, that's you had your own private tutor.
That's right. Learn the game the way it's being played.
Yeah.
And there's nothing better than having that tutor right there in your same home with you.
Absolutely. Yeah, a guy you look up to.
You sit down and you eat at the dinner table and you know that he's not giving anything any more than you're getting. So how come he's so good? Well, the only thing that I took from that was, okay, I have to work out harder if I'm going to be as good, if not better, than he is.
Yeah. No,
okay,
that's good.
So Tom would work out for, you know, 2 hours like we'd normally work out. Well, then I'd work out another hour and a half. Or another hour. Or I'd do something that he wouldn't do. When he'd go to bed at night, I would go out and run where, you know, everybody else has gone to sleep. Or I'd get up early in the morning and he'd hear me in the other room, you know, and he couldn't figure out what that was. And he goes and opens up the door and he says, what are you doing in there? I'm doing tons and tons of push-ups to get stronger and stronger and stronger.
Yeah.
So constantly keep saying to yourself, there's a chance of getting them, there's a chance of being better, but I've got to be bigger and stronger and faster, and you know, and these are all the things that would run through my mind. These were all the means of determination that I would get to be, hope that I would get to be better than my brother one day.
Right. Interesting. So many people I've talked to for the show, you know, had an older brother who picked on him, beat on him, that kind of thing, and provided that immediate competition and motivation to get better. That's such a great asset as you look back on it.
Oh, I look back on it and I say that if I was asked, if someone, God or someone said, would you like to do this all over again? And I would say, yes. And if he said, but I'll only let you have one thing that you had when you came along as a young boy. And I would say, okay, I want my brother.
Yeah.
And I want my brother exactly the way it was, 2 years older than me and there and gone through it and helped to take me through it. And it was just the perfect carrot, you know. I mean, here's a guy sitting at the table with you, eating the same thing you're eating every single night, hearing the same lessons that you're hearing, getting in the same, getting the same spankings and that type of thing you're getting, you know. And he can do it, then you can do it.
Yeah.
And it was easy to say because, I know that we weren't created differently. He was just created a little earlier than I was.
Right, right. You know? Okay. Now, you competed in your first Olympics in 1952 while you were still in high school, correct?
Yes, I was a junior in high school.
So you were like, the summer, was it going into your junior year or your senior year?
No, I was in the summer of my junior year.
Okay. Okay, before your senior year in high school.
Before my senior year.
Okay, and you placed second in the decathlon to Bob Mathias, correct?
Yes, I did.
Okay, and you had never competed in the pole vault, discus, javelin, or 1,500-meter run before that Olympics. So, first of all, how did you make the Olympic team as a high school kid in New Jersey?
Well, it's not the way it is now. Because now you have to compete in a certain amount of decathlons in order to get points enough to make it.
Mm-hmm.
The way it was in those days is that you walk out on the field and you enter into the decathlon, and they had a bunch of guys that would come, and they would take the top three.
Uh-huh.
So the first decathlon I participated in was the Olympic Trials.
Mm.
And I got second to Bob Mathias.
Wow. And where were the trials?
And Floyd Simmons got third, and we went on from there to the Olympic Games in Helsinki, Finland, and I got second at the Olympic Games.
Wow. So where were the trials, the Olympic trials?
In Tulare, California, Bob Mathias' hometown.
Okay, and then what motivated you, or how did you wind up going to the trials, not even having competed in half of the events?
Well, that's kind of a long story. My coach one day got a hold of me and he said, "Milt, you know," which I think coaches today don't do enough of, but he got a hold of me and he said, "Milt, what would you like to do? What would you like to be?" And when he said, "What would you like to be?" I looked at him and I said, "I would like to be the best athlete in Plainfield High School." And then after getting a little bit more courage, I turned around and said, I would like to be the best athlete in New Jersey. You know, and then after getting a little bit more courage, I said, Coach, I'd really like to be the best athlete in America. And he looked at me and he said, "I think you can be the best athlete in the world."
Mm.
And that took my dream from the size of a baseball that I was holding in my hand to the size of the world.
Yeah.
You know, for him to say that to me, to have somebody who was a coach, who believed in this stuff, who knew this stuff better than I knew it, and that type of thing, that could actually look at you and say that to you, all the confidence in the world. You have all the confidence in the world that you can do it.
So yeah,
I turned around and said to him, I said, "Oh, that's great, coaches." I said, "Okay," and I went off to class. And of course, I sat in class, and the only thing I could think about was being the best athlete in the world. So I ran back to the gym, at the halftime, and I said to him, "I said, Coach, what do I have to do to be the best athlete in the world?" You know. And he said, "Well, let's go down to the library." We went down to the library, and we got a book on Jim Thorpe. And he gave it to me, and I read it that night, and I came back to him, and I said, "Okay, let's do it, like this here." Well, first, before that, he said, "Well, you have to win the decathlon." And I went back to my classroom thinking, okay, I have to win the decathlon. I went back to my classroom thinking, what the hell is a decathlon? I said, I'd never heard of that before. What is this thing? You know, so I went back to him, and then he said, let's go down to the library. So we went down to the library, got the book on Jim Thorpe. I read the book and, you know, skimmed through it and read it and realized it was 10 events. So I came back to him, and I said, let's do it. And he said, okay. So we started practicing in different events and that type of thing. And he was kind of putting together the scores here. Well, go out and throw the discus, you know. But I didn't throw it in competition, but he sent me out to throw the discus. He said, go out and throw the discus, you know. So I go out and I throw the discus. And, you know, I get a pretty good record when you put it up against the Catholic guys. You know, it was nothing to put up against the regular guys that did the discus. And then he turned around and, you know, and he says, well, let's do the pole vault. And the first time I tried to do the pole broke. So
yeah.
It was one of those bamboo poles.
Bamboo, I was going to say, yeah.
So
before
I said,
fiberglass.
Well, that's enough of that. So I said, get him to change this event, coach, and put another one in there. I said, I'll do whatever else there is, you know.
He said,
no. He said, you've got to do this event. He said, they won't change the events.
You can't customize your own decathlon, huh?
Right. So finally, he got me a Swedish steel pole. So I used the Swedish steel pole, and that worked pretty good. So I turned around and practiced the pole vault a little bit, and I could get over 11, 12 foot, you know, so that wasn't too bad for what the guys were doing, except Bob Richards was, you know, doing, 16 feet. And he says, well, Bob Richards, you know, does 16 feet and so forth. He said, but you in the decathlon now have so many other things that are better. I mean, you run a better 100 than him. You run a better, you run a better quarter mile than him. You know, you're better hurdler than him and all that. So he began to point these things out. So he began to try to impress people around town that I had what it took to make the team. And, of course, they took up a collection, and they raised like $1,500. So he says, okay, we're going to Tulare, California for the track meet. Now, the school didn't want to pay him for being off to go do this.
Mm-hmm.
But they turned around and he said, well, he was going anyhow. So he turns around, he leaves to go anyhow, and, you know, he gets me out in California, and he puts me in the open events. He puts me in the 100, and he puts me in the hurdles. Well, I got bombed out of the 100, and I made it in the, I got fourth or fifth in the hurdles, and I hit a hurdle. So he said, well, you know, don't worry about it. You ran a good time, you know, and everything. And so now we'll go up to Tulare, California. So we went up to Tulare, California. We entered into the decathlon, and back in those days, you just you enter in and they take the top three guys, and I made second.
And I mean, could anybody enter this meet? I mean, they can't.
Anybody at all could enter.
Anybody in the country could go try out for the Olympic team in that one meet.
Yeah.
Wow.
But you see, they don't do it nowadays that way because,
sure,
first of all, too many people will come and enter into the meet and then pull a leg muscle or fake pulling a leg muscle and drop out and turn around and say, well, you know, I was in the Olympic trials, but I got hurt.
Right, right.
They get guys that you have to participate in the Olympic Games, and you have to make a certain amount of points.
Sure.
For them to take you, okay?
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. It's how did you and your coach get out to California?
We flew out.
Okay, you flew out.
Yeah, and we raised about $1,500 at the, in my hometown.
Yeah, you must have felt like you're representing a lot of people then, huh?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, representing the town.
The flight itself had to be an experience. I guess that's the first time you're in an airplane? Or
no, that was the second time, actually.
Okay.
I flew to England.
Ah.
Because I got second in a track meet, indoor track meet, behind Harrison Dillard.
Uh-huh.
And so Dillard didn't want to go to England to run, so I took the trip.
Okay.
He gave me the trip.
You had some experiences then at a young age.
Yeah, yeah.
So you are the silver medalist in the 1952 Olympics in Helsinki behind Bob Mathias.
Right.
You got to be a big man on campus when you come back for your senior year of high school, huh?
Oh, yeah. They had coaches and people calling up and saying, don't let this kid play football. You know, he's got such a great career as a track athlete and everything. And Begier would say, my football coach would say, well, don't let your boys get in the way. Because Milt's going to be a terror, and he's going to run over him, and he's going to play football. And I had the best season that I had.
Yeah, so you played football that senior year. Did you swim as well?
No, I didn't swim. I didn't swim my junior year or my senior year.
Okay. But you had been an All-American swimmer as a sophomore in high school.
As a sophomore.
Okay. So how is it that you get from Plainfield, New Jersey, to Indiana University coming out of high school?
Well, my coach went to talked to several schools. And with Indiana University, he said to them, he said, here's what I want. I want it in his contract, and I want it in his whatever agreement we make, that Milt is to graduate. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
In other words, you know, back in those days, they were getting a lot of black athletes to come to school, and heck, they weren't graduating. They weren't, their scholarships went for a certain amount of years. If they got hurt or anything like that, their scholarships were taken from them and all that type of stuff. You know what went on.
Yeah.
And Begier was going to make sure that that wasn't going to happen to me. What he said was that you will always have a contract there for you to graduate.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, if you decide to go into professional football and then come back a few years later, your scholarship will still be there.
Okay.
You know.
So you're playing football and running track at IU.
Yeah.
And how did that go?
Well, it went good for a while. You know, there were some good things. Back in those days, it was a little bit rough. You know.
Yeah.
You know, I came to Indiana University. The coach Gordon Fisher was the one that sponsored me to come to Indiana. Because, you know, you had to be a sponsor, have a sponsor. But at the same token, when track season come, Gordon Fisher looked at me and he said, I've never coached a decathlete. I don't know what to do with you.
So you're on your own.
More or less.
Yeah.
The last coach I really had was my high school coach.
Right.
So, I'm kind of like looking at him thinking, oh, all right, okay, I'll find a way to do this, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And he would coach me in the hurdle sometimes and, you know, coach me in the 220 sprint or something like that, you know. And at Indiana, I pulled an inch and a half of muscle off the bone in my leg, and I was, because I had gotten a knot in my leg and it pulled. And I was told that I would never run again.
What year was that?
By three of the top doctors in Indiana. That was my sophomore year.
Sophomore year, okay.
And I turned around and said to myself, this can't be. Well, one of the doctors looked at me and said, we shouldn't tell you that you're not going to ever run again. We should tell you that you're not going to be as quick, as fast as you were, you know, like that.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I turned around and I said, well, okay, this doesn't sound good, you know. And I went back and I worked very hard and diligently on swimming and walking and running the stairs and all of those things to kind of get my leg back. And I think we ran in the Drake relays, and he put me on the opening leg of the 880 relay. Was it 880? Yeah, 880 relay. And I ran about 4/10 of a second off the off the 220. National record. So I said to myself, I'm back.
Yeah.
See?
Absolutely.
And I continued to work out and everything. And I got a D in physiology. So I left Indiana and I went in the service.
You left Indiana after your, what, sophomore year?
Yeah, after my sophomore year. And I went into Indiana in 1956 because I had to make up that D before they would let me compete.
Oh, okay.
Okay, so
you couldn't go to summer school, or?
I got a year, I got 6 months to a year to go before the Olympic Games. And I said, I can't afford to take this year off and not train. So I went in the Navy, and the Navy agreed to give me time off to train if my record was good enough. So, of course, I'm standing there saying I'm the best athlete in the world, you know. And my commander looked at my record, and he said, well, we'll see. So he gave me time off to go ahead and train. And, of course, I trained every day for 7.5 to 8 hours a day. And when it came down to time for the Olympics, I was ready.
Yeah. Oh, so you basically, though, you were self-coached, weren't you?
I was self-coached, but, you know, in a funny sort of a way. I mean, I would get a hold of somebody like Greg Bell, and because Greg Bell went to Indiana, and he was a long jumper that made the Olympic team.
Right.
We worked out for 2 hour workouts, 2 1-hour workouts twice, and I put 2 feet more onto my long jump.
Okay.
So I would get a hold of these guys that knew what they were doing and say, hey, look, guys, can you help me with this?
Yeah.
And next thing you know, Daryl Hooper, for instance, would turn around and help me with the shot put a little bit. Any of these guys would help you out. Who was it? I would race against Lee Calhoun, and his coach would be there sometimes. His coach would help me out. So it was a series of trying to take advantage of everything that you could take advantage of, learn it, go back to your base and work as hard as you could work at it. And the next time I would see a Greg Bell or somebody like this, I said, come over to the long jump pit. Just see what I'm doing here. Am I doing this right? And I'm doing that right. And they say, hey, you're right on target. Or, you know, you weren't. And that's the way I progressed ahead.
Yeah. Yeah, we should mention that when you were a sophomore at IU, you won the high hurdles at both the AAU and NCAA meets.
Yeah, right.
And you did play football. Indiana did not have much of a football program when you were there, but how did your football, those 2 years of football go for you?
Football, you know, as you said again, the program wasn't, we didn't have, we were building a team. I think that we would have made a much better team if Cookie Gilchrist had a game to Indiana, which I think he was, they were trying to get him and a couple other guys that had come. I think we would have built the team that we wanted, but, you know, it was very tough. I remember that they used to run me in practice. We could move the ball between the 20-yard lines. And then when we would get to the 20-yard line, they stopped running me. And we get in practice, and they would start running me. They would run me 4 out of 5 times into the end zone. And I got ticked off one day, and I said, why are we doing this? You know, and of course, you know, you're a black kid from Indiana, and you don't say any, I mean, and you're in the South, so you don't say these kind of things. You just be quiet and get coached. But I said, you know, why are we doing this? So the coach said, Bernie Crimmins, he says, it's because we are not getting into the end zone and so forth. I said, well, I never run the ball past 20-yard line unless I, you know, run it from midfield somewhere or the other goal line all the way to the other goal line. I said, when we get to the 20-yard line, I'm become a blocker. So he looked at me and he said, well, that's enough out of you.
Wow.
And I said, I backed off. I said, okay. And he said, another word out of you. No, he said, you'll run 50 laps this evening. And I said, look, I'll run 50 laps. I don't care about the 50 laps. I want to know why I'm doing this. you know, because I mean, I was literally wore out. And I said, now I want to know why I'm doing this. He said, you're doing it because I tell you to do it. I said, doesn't make any sense.
Right.
Doesn't make any sense to keep practicing this when I hit the 20-yard, we hit the 20-yard line as a team. I never touched the ball again. And that made him mad. And he said, well, you'll do another 50 laps after practice. I said, fine. And I didn't say anything and went the rest of the practice, you know, continuing to play. And I continued to run hard and practice like we were supposed to, you know. At the end of practice, I run the 50, 60, 100 laps, whatever it was. And at the end of it, I'm down on my hands and knees breathing heavy, and he comes over and he grabs me by the arm and he lets pick me up, you know, and I snatch my arm away from him, and I looked at him and I told him, I said, the one thing that you'll never be able to do in your entire life, you'll never be able to beat me physically.
Yeah.
You know, like that. So I went on into the locker room. The season progressed. It got to the point where we were playing, Michigan. And Michigan had already made it to the Rose Bowl. They're just going to play Indiana, and the word was out that they're going to beat Indiana by 6 touchdowns, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So, which is something that, of course, ticked me off anyhow. So anyhow, we had this play which I would curl out of the line, and off the end of the line would come Kramer to protect against me. And they would let me hook up. And as I hooked up, they'd throw me the ball, and Kramer would tackle me. So I get up, and I look down at the end of the field, and there's nobody behind me. So we keep running this play all the time, and the score is Michigan 9, Indiana 6. And so we got about 2 minutes left to play.
Are you in Ann Arbor or Bloomington?
Ann Arbor.
Okay.
So we got about 2 minutes left to play. And they call that play again. So I say to the guys in the huddle, I said, I'm going to stop and go. And the guys say to me, no, you got to run the play the way the coach told you to run it. I said, I'm stopping and I'm going. And the guy said, no, you can't do that. You got to run the play the way it's on the thing. I said, well, if you throw it, you're going to throw it to Kramer because I'm going to stop and go. Like that. So we took up so much time, we had to call timeout. And now Crimmins he's livid. He comes out on the field now, he's pissed off, he's upset. I mean, he's livid. And he turns around and he looks at me and he says, you run the play the way I diagrammed it. So I went into my frightened black boy mode in that time, and I said, yes, sir. Yes, sir. Yes, sir, Mr. Crimmins, I'll run it the way you say, sir. So they get back, and they call the play again. And I said, I'm going to stop, and I'm going. And the guy said, Melt, you're going to catch hell. I said, I'm stopping, and I'm going. If you want to throw the ball to Kramer, throw it to him. But I'll be in the end zone. Throw it to me. I stopped. They called the play. I hooked up, and then I went. I was 20 yards down the field before Kramer realized what happened. They threw the ball. We won the game 13-9.
Ah.
Crimmins never said 2 words.
He never said a word about it, huh?
Never said 2 words.
He probably took full credit in the papers, though.
Well, I don't know who took full credit, but, you know, I came to win, you know. And if you see some things that you could win with, sometimes coaches listen to you and sometimes they don't.
Yeah, hey, coaches are not always right, that's for sure. You know? Who was the IU quarterback at that time?
Eugene Chakowski, I think.
Okay. Okay. Did he say anything to you? Did you guys talk about it? Because it took some – well, I guess it didn't take any nerve on his part. You were so wide open, he would have been crazy not to throw it to you. But
well, the thing was, is I told him, I said, if you want to throw it to the hook spot, you're going to throw it to Kramer because I'm going to be gone.
Yeah.
I'm going to be gone.
Yeah. Well, Indiana didn't win many games in Michigan back then, that's for sure.
I think we only won 3 or 4 games that year.
Yeah, yeah. Amazing. That kind of reminds me, George Taliaferro told the story when he played football at IU as a freshman. The first game was at Michigan, and he ran for like 100 yards, and IU won that game.
Yeah.
But, you know, we could pretty much count the games Indiana has won at Michigan on one hand over the years, I'm sure.
Yeah.
You know, so you played 2 years of football.
Yeah. Yeah.
We should add, you know, players went both ways back in those days, and you also played defensive back, and you had a game against Ohio University where you had three interceptions.
Yeah.
But running back was your best position?
Running back was my best position. It was, I loved it, but I didn't mind banging defensively.
Uh-huh.
Didn't mind banging at all defensively.
Okay. Well, let's talk about the 56 Olympics. You know, this is really the highlight of your athletic career. So you played 2 years at IU, then you go into the Navy for a year, right?
Mm-hmm.
Basically to train for the Olympics.
Right.
And you go to the Olympic trials.
Went in the Navy for 18 months.
Okay, 18 months. And then you, of course, now Bob Mathias is no longer in the Olympics, right? He's out of the way?
He's out of the way.
And Rafer Johnson is your primary competition, isn't he?
Rafer Johnson's considered to be the best around, the world record holder and all of that sort of thing.
Okay, now did you place first in the trials?
No, Rafer placed first in the trials. Rafer. I didn't go to the trials to see could I beat Rafer Johnson or not. I went to see where his weakness was and to make the team.
Right.
It didn't really matter to me whether I got first, second, or third.
Right. Okay. So the 56 Olympics are in Australia, a long way away.
Mm-hmm.
And you win the gold medal. And, in fact, you barely missed a world record in the decathlon down in Australia. From what I've read, the pole vault was still an issue for you, right? That was still...
Yeah, the pole vault. I went out at, I think it was 11.4, and normally I pole vaulted somewhere around 13 feet.
Mm-hmm.
So
okay.
If I had made 11.4, I'd have been the first man in the world to go over 8,000 points.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Wait a minute now. Let me make sure that's true. Yeah, I think I would have been the first one to go over 8,000 points.
All right. So now your primary event in track is the hurdles. And if I remember correctly or heard correctly, you are the only person, only decathlete who ever held a world record in one of the events, right?
Right.
So you held the world record in the hurdles.
Well, I set the world record after the Olympic Games, though.
After the Olympic Games, though. Okay.
Indoors and outdoors.
Okay.
I set a world record indoors and outdoors on the Olympic champion, Lee Calhoun.
Oh, okay.
At the time, and Lee and I were friends and buddies, and we trained some together and that kind of thing. But at the end of all of the track and field and stuff, all I had to do was to train one event now.
Yeah, right. Oh, yeah. So tell me about the Olympics in Australia. You know, I mean, what highlights stand out, you know, from that experience?
What highlight actually stood out, I think, was that I was not to be the one they said that would win it.
Uh-huh.
They said that, and this was, I guess, the top 10 news writers in the States. They said that they picked it and they put us all in Life magazine or one of the magazines and stuff. They said Rayford would win it. They said the Russian would take second and Campbell could do no better than third.
Oh, so again, you have motivation.
Yeah, always. Always. I had motivation because Rayford and them were top guys.
Yeah. Did you get along with Rafer?
Oh, yeah, I got along with him. But, I got along with everybody until the time came to compete.
Right.
Time came to compete a day or 2 days before that. I didn't talk to you or anybody else.
Okay. Because I read somewhere that Rafer, came to your room in Australia? You guys had a conversation before the meet?
Yeah, he came to the room one time and he said, well, how do you think things are going to go, you know? And I told him, I said, it's a bad time you show up. I said, this one's mine, I'm going to win it, and the next one's yours.
Yeah, and he did win the gold in 1960, of course.
Yes, he did.
Now, it's reported that Rafer had some injuries, torn stomach muscle or a bad knee. Was that a factor?
Well, he said he had a torn stomach muscle. I didn't know that. I knew of it when they said he did, and that, I don't know, something else was wrong.
Mm-hmm.
I had a high fever and I was all stuffed up and I had, shin splints.
Uh-huh.
you know. So I was ailing too, but hell, I don't say anything about it because I won.
Right, right.
You know what I mean? And I don't think I would say anything about it anyhow.
Right.
But, you know, I guess, you know, and Rayford is a hell of a guy. He's a great guy. So
yeah.
Don't let me, you know, happen to rattle on and say something that puts him down, because it's not. He's a great guy. He's a great competitor, a great athlete,
mm-hmm.
you know. And I just, at that particular, I mean, let me put it this way. All of us guys that can win at the decathlon are great athletes.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, there's no way that you're going to put anybody down, okay? But as I told him, and as I told my mom, you know, that this one was mine, and I was going to get it, and I was going to win it. I felt that I paid the biggest price in the world to be the world's best athlete. I worked out 7.5 to 8 hours a day for the last 2.5 years. I don't think there was another athlete in the world putting in that much time.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So I could walk with confidence and say, you've paid the price.
Yeah.
And you know, people will say, well, you were awfully cocky. Well, you know, I believed in what I saw in my own mind. Not what you would write in the paper, or not the statistics that everyone would write about and speak about. Because if you turned around and realized that, I think I've been the only athlete in the modern world that has had the decathlon won in 6 events.
Oh, you had it won after 6 events?
After 6 events.
Oh, my. Okay.
Everybody began to say, if Johnson or somebody else is going to win this, they're going to have to shoot Campbell. You know, so, you know, and I'm not saying that to brag, but that was my plan.
Yeah.
Because I knew the events that Rayford was strong in. I knew where Rayford was weak. Okay. And the day before that he came in my room, I was taking advantage of I think, his weakest point. And his weakest point, he wasn't mentally as strong as I was.
Yeah.
And I'm not just saying that because I beat him. I'm saying that because how can I say this without making it light? When I said that I was going to beat him, I mean, you would think that somebody came across the room and hit him with a baseball bat.
Oh, he was shocked by that, huh?
Oh, yeah. And that is a tactic that all of these older guys, they taught me. Harrison Dillard used to get at the starting line and look at us guys and say, hey, you guys pick out who's going to get second and third. I'm winning this.
Yeah.
You know, and that would rattle people.
Sure.
And
sure.
If you've never been to the Olympic Games, I don't care what anybody says, I don't care how great you are. If you've never been to the Olympic Games, when you get into that arena, into that setting, that rattles you. I don't care who you are. And I knew Rayford Johnson was rattled, a little bit, not much, because he'd been reading his clippings, he'd been reading the articles they've been saying, he's been listening to the interviews they've been giving him, you know?
Yep.
But now all of a sudden you got a guy coming along that's been there to say, I know what I have to do.
Yeah, you'd been there before.
I've been there and done that.
Yeah.
So I know what I have to do. Am I willing to pay the price to do it? Yes, I am.
Yeah.
And now I have to ask myself honestly, Milt, you got 2 days before the decathlon. Have you paid the price? I paid the price.
Yeah.
I paid the price.
Sure.
I paid it in gold.
The last event was the 1,500-meter run, right?
Right.
I think it still is. What was that like going into that, knowing the position you were in, but you're not a distance runner? Well, that's not really a distance run, but still 2 laps. That had to be...
Well, that was 4 laps, 1,500 meters.
That's right. What am I saying? Yeah, you go into the 1,500-meter run, 4 laps. You know, you're a hurdler. You're a sprinter. You know, you're 6'3", 210 pounds. You know, you don't have the build of a distance runner.
Right.
So what do you recall from that last event, knowing what was ahead of you?
Well, knowing what was ahead of me, the only thing that I really wanted, because I think that if I just ran and finished the race, that I was going to win the gold medal.
Yeah, you didn't have to meet a particular time or whatever, huh?
No, but I was running, trying to do another personal best. You know, I wanted to go out not a slacker. I wanted to go out giving it all that I had. You know, and one of the things that I've learned in my life is you never cheat the journey. So you give it everything you got. And every time, every moment that you're out there, or don't go out there, you know. So coming to the mile, I'd never run a great mile, you know. I'd run 4:50 or something. No, I mean, I'd run, you know, 4:50 something or something. But this time I ran 15 seconds better than I ever run in my life.
Oh, great. Great way to go out.
It was a great mile. I got a lot of help from the Australian kid because he pulls up alongside of me and he says, come on, big boy, let's run, you know.
Uh-huh.
I'm looking at this guy and he's not breathing hard and I'm trying to suck in the air in the whole stadium. You know? I'm breathing like mad and I see the Russian down the track about 60 yards ahead of us, you know. And then I get motivated again. I say, hey, catch this guy.
Yeah.
And I got to catch him. I got to catch him, you know. So, the Australian kid said, pick it up, pick it up. Now I get annoyed at him because he can talk while he can run, and I can barely breathe while I'm running.
Yeah.
You know? So I turn around, and finally we go into the last turn, and I see that I picked up about 10, 15 yards on the Russian. So I said, I'm going to get him. So I turned around, and again, there's my motivation. And we ran it past the Russian. We were about 20 yards ahead of him now, and we get down to the tape and we cross it pretty much even.
Mm.
And I ran a better time. I ran another personal best, so that was better time than I had run.
Yeah. So you're in Australia. You've won a gold medal. You have no family or friends there really to celebrate with. You're dying from that 1,500 meter run. You know, what are you feeling then, and how do you personally celebrate that type of moment?
Well, it's a phenomenal celebration because you're turning around now and you're saying, you know, with me, it was a matter of I said this is what I'm going to do. Now it's finished. I've done it. I've done exactly what I said I was going to do. I didn't disappoint anybody. I disappointed a couple of people in Plainfield that bet against me, but shame on them.
People were betting against you back home?
Yeah. Well, many of them bet with me, but many of them, many of them read the clippings and everything, and they didn't believe me when I told them I was going to win.
Yeah. Wow.
And, it's kind of hard because when an athlete comes up and tells you he's going to beat a bunch of other great athletes, you know, you kind of look at him like he's crazy, especially when the statistics and the numbers say, well, this guy is a world record holder. This guy has broken the world's record once and come back, and you haven't broken the world's record. There's no way that you're going to beat these guys. But, somebody wrote an article in the paper. I think it was Elliot Denman from New Jersey, and he said, I think that if Milt Campbell said that he was going to win, it sounds like Milt Campbell. It sounds like something that he would say. And if they were going to beat him, and nobody, I don't think anybody would have beat him on those 2 days.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And from the opening gun, I went out ahead, you know.
Yeah.
I went out ahead in 100. Then Rayford normally jumped about 2-3 feet better than I jumped in the long jump, so he looked to come back and kind of make up the ground that I took on him in the 100. And he jumped 24 something, and I jumped 24 something, which was a quarter of an inch less than him. So it was that type of thing that I was out front. Then I went on to be out front in the shot put and be out front in the high jump and be out front in the quarter mile. And so when it came at the end of the day, I was ahead of a Rayford about 140 or 50-something points. I was ahead of the Russian about 300, 400 points. And when it came to the hurdles, I ran away with it, you know. I had the best time. I think I set an Olympic record for the hurdles there that year, and so I'm now 500 and something points ahead of the Rayford and 600 points ahead of the Russian. So, you know, for them to make up that type of a ground on me, they had to be super great and everything, or I had to be shot.